F2. Number 16A.
That's clear. And so, you can take any idea of principle. You take the idea, say, of life. Of life where you feel, oh, will I be able to go the way of life? I have seen the way of life. I have seen that there is only one method of life. Can I go it? How? What makes me make go it? What impels me that it causes me to go that way? Just by humanly wishing it? No, I can't do it. It's not strong enough. But if God impels me to do it, then I will do it. So unite with that one life. There is only one life in being. And in consciousness, we just can claim that we are one with that one life, which is the way of life. And therefore, because that way of life has a Christ, it translates itself fully to me as the full way of life, forcing me, filling me with that consciousness of going the way of life, of treading the way of life, of pushing on the way of life, of always going on and on and on, never stopping, never looking back, always having the eye on the ball. That's what happens. So you see, all these claims are claims which encounter each one of us, that we can't go the way of life, that we don't have the courage to go the way of life, that we don't have the impulsion to go the way of life. These are claims. These are claims which are far worse than any physical claim, any claim of disease. Far worse, because they stop us to go there, to unfold in our life. So let's handle those. Let's demonstrate our dominion over those. But we can't do them except we have a Christ who gives us the power to do it. So, or let's take truth. See, perhaps we feel that we have not enough strength within ourselves to affirm the truth, of claiming the truth. Well, all right. We don't need to have that strength within us. Let's draw the strength from God. And we can see that in reality nothing is ever going on but the Word of God and the Christ of God and the Christianity of God and the signs of God. Therefore we can just tap that enormous holy city and see, all right, if I'm one with God who is truth, and if I claim my oneness with that truth, and I claim that I cannot be anything else but that truth, that truth always has a Christ and therefore translates that truthfulness, that claiming of the truth, that affirming of the truth in all its fullness to me, and makes me admit and claim the truth and stand for the truth. And so God gives me the power to do it. Or you can go to love, and in love perhaps so often you feel that one's life has no fulfillment. Has no fulfillment. Well, why should we accept such a belief? It's a belief. Everything that is not of the nature of God is a belief. So let's handle that belief. Because inwardly in us we all would see and like to see fulfillment. Fulfillment in everything. But how can I have it? Well, only through that way that I see that fulfillment is an idea of God and not an idea of people and of human beings. So let's unite with that idea of love, which is always fulfilled, which has always the consummation of everything, which comprises always the perfection of everything, the completion of everything. And through our constant unity and conscious unity, that nothing is ever going on in being but that completion and consummation of love, then I begin to see that is the Christ fact about me, and therefore comes to me and fills me with that idea of completion and consummation and fulfillment, and establishes in me and fulfills in me the fulfillment of everything that is divine. That which only can fulfill that which is divine. Well, I just don't want to go on. I think it gets a bit heavy in the cloth, and that's quite natural. Quite natural, it doesn't matter. And so you see how to use these laws. How to use these laws. They all tackle a claim. A claim which each one has to handle, because the human mind is the same in each one. Perhaps because we have a few minutes, I may try to find that sentence here that just came into my mind in Apocalypse, where she says, you know, about handling really evil. See where she says about that angel with the little book, that Christ angel with the little book, with that science in its hand. See, the little book is the science of being. Said, this is the same book contains the revelation of divine science, the right foot, or dominant power, of which was upon the sea. The dominant power was upon the sea. And the sea here is explained as elementary, latent error, the source of all error's visible forms. That's what we handle with these claims, with these laws. That's the right foot. It's standing on that sea, of error, which is elementary. These are quite elementary problems. They are not specific to each to one or the other. Rheumatism or a headache or a cancer may be specific to one. But these claims which we handle here are elementary. They are not specific to one. It's something which each one has to handle. So it's the right foot upon elementary, and it's latent error. See, the moment an error becomes acute, we get going. We get busy. But as long as it's latent, we are just sleeping on and slumbering on. We just admit to ourselves that error is there and that's that. That we cannot understand God, that the fullness of God is not in us, and so on. That's the latent error. These laws handle latent error, the source of all visible error. Of all visible error. If we can use these laws consecutively, systematically, consistently, coherently, then we handle the noumena of error, and not the phenomena of error. We handle the noumena of error, the source of visible error. That should help us to prevent error to become acute. Is that English? You see, to spring up and manifest itself. Therefore, what we really do is more the not the curative art of Christian Science, which we hear so much culture, but the preventive art of Christian Science. I like the preventive art of Christian Science for myself, because I don't like to be sick. I'm a silly at that. So, with these laws, we really do something much more fundamental than just to solve here and there a problem which is acute, which doesn't mean that we also naturally should handle the acute error. The angel's left foot was upon the earth. You see, upon the earth, that which is tangible, not like the sea where you never know where you are, you see. That is, a secondary power was exercised upon visible error and audible sin. It's a secondary power. What we do with these laws is a primary power. It's a more fundamental power. We really use here absolute Christian Science to handle error, and not only Christian Science to handle visible error and audible sin. Is that clear? If we see that naturally, then we begin to see the importance of what we do. And when one sees the importance of it, one likes to do it. All right. Philippians tomorrow.
Now, in this paragraph on obstetrics, Mrs. Eddy says that a spiritual idea has not a single element of error, and this truth removes properly whatever is offensive. So let's just remind ourselves before we start again that we are giving birth to a new idea, to the idea of science, the idea of divine science. And so let's just be a mother to this idea and see that this idea has not a single element of error. Therefore, it has not a single element of error which says this idea is difficult to grasp. That's not the idea of mine. So let's see that this idea has not a single element of error which would say that this idea is too far above our heads, that it is complicated, or that it has no power, or that it has no saving power in itself, because it, as an idea of God, this idea just is closed. This idea is just closed with everything which belongs to God and which is of the nature of God. So this idea has power, it has inspiration, it has within itself the seed of unfoldment, the seed of growth. It has within itself the nature to identify itself to us in a clear way, in a lovely way, in an understandable way, in a satisfactory way, in a way that it satisfies us, that this idea has in itself the power of the soul, you see, to bless us beyond words. Just keep that within our consciousness, that this idea has not a single element of error. And so this idea has in itself the power of principle, the power of demonstration. It has in itself the power of authority, the power of government. This idea will begin to rule us. This idea is taking over in within us and begins to use us and to lead us into those channels and into those line of unfoldment and into those line of work which the idea wants us to do. So this idea is complete. It has the nature of life. It has not a single element that is against life. Therefore this idea rejuvenates us. It vitalizes us. This idea has in itself the power to give us a newness of life, a new sense of life. It has the power within itself, you see, that it leads us and pushes us on the way of life, on the highway of life. So this idea has in itself the power to make us spontaneous, to give us inspiration, to make us inspired. It has just everything within itself. And so this idea has within itself the whole nature of truth. It has not a single element of error which could deny the nature of truth. Namely, that this idea is building up within ourselves the new stature of the fullness of Christ, the true stature of manhood. It builds up within ourselves the standard of true manhood, the standard of that manhood which is neither male nor female, where we combine as the compound idea man all the ideas of truth. And so this idea has not a single element of error which tries to deny love, the nature of love, because this idea is fully closed with all that love is. And so let's just see that what we are witnessing this week is just the birth of an idea of love. Therefore an idea which is of the nature of love, therefore an idea which works within an enormous plane, within an enormous design, within that plane of universal salvation, where each one of us is taking part in working out the glory of God, that purpose of God which God has set as its purpose. And so this idea within ourselves is a mother that is always blessed by the child and has never any trouble with that child, with that idea. This idea is just going to bless us beyond words. And we are just not going to accept this hideous belief that we will not be blessed for what we are doing. We are, and God blesses it. So let's just keep that in mind, that this idea we are considering this week embosoms within itself everything that God has. Now, yesterday we began with that second triad of the epistles, Paul's epistle, Galatians and Ephesians. And today we take now the third, Philippians. All three, Galatians, Ephesians, and Philippians, together have one common denominator. They all try to explain that man has a reciprocal relationship to the Christ and to the working of the Christ. In Galatians, we had first a statement of this relationship, stating that man has a relationship with the Christ, which is the only Savior for man. That man's relationship with that Christ invalidates the necessity to fall back on any other agent as a saving agent, as a saving power, except the one Christ. That Christ is sufficient and is all sufficient in every situation. So there we had just that statement that the Christ is the all and only Christ. Then we go a step further, having accepted that fact, we go a step further to Christ as Christ, to the Christ sense of it, where we have to claim and fully claim that one and all Savior. So Ephesians is full of that sense that the Christ translates itself in its fullness to man, and giving to man the fullness of being. And that we have to be consciously conscious of that fact and put on that consciousness, just as we will put on the whole garment, armor, and not just the helmet, not just take the spear, not just take the shield, not just take the sword, not just gird ourselves. He says, put on the whole garment of Christ. In other words, we have that category B, which says, claim with all your consciousness, with all your might, with all your love, and with all your wholeness, claim that very fact that the Christ translates. What? That fullness of God in a full way to man, filling man with Christ's fullness. Christ in all. And so he presents that translation in the translation order, giving always in each one of the subjects this in full sense of Christ's glory and Christ's blessing. Now, we come to Philippians, and Philippians just goes one little step further than Ephesians and just draws the consequences of Ephesians by seeing that if the Christ in Ephesians comes to us in its fullness and begins to work in us in its fullness, that then, therefore, this Christ in us will win a victory within us. And so we come to the sea, where we always get the victory, the triumph. Here it is Christ's triumph, namely that the Christ works so triumphantly within us that it leads everything towards perfection. He doesn't yet show really the perfection of man. That comes later. It's still in the Christ, you see. It's still in the Christ. The Christ is still that modus operandi which comes from God to man and works in man. So what we get here in Christianity is always a sense of triumph, of demonstration, of proof, working out things. So here in Philippians we get that wonderful sense, and you will feel it, how everything is working towards perfection in us through that Christ consciousness. The perfectibility of the Christ is shown. Not the perfection of man. That comes later. It's still the Christ, and the Christ works out the perfectibility of the true idea in man. The third is always that Christianity sense, which from the point of view of demonstration, or from the plane of Christian Science, is that steadfastly abiding in the understanding. Here in Philippians, this steadfast abiding, this remaining unshakable, unwaveringly in one's understanding of the Christ, is mostly depicted through the term rejoice. Because if we can rejoice, that's the highest sense of acknowledging the truth. We rejoice when we are so sure of our victory, when we are so inwardly, so perfectly at ease that everything is all right. So if when the term rejoice, rejoice, rejoice appears in Philippians, as in no other epistle, that term appears so often as in Philippians, we know it's that quality in us from the human point of view which embodies the Christianity sense of this Christ. The Christianity sense which acknowledges without doubt, if we would doubt we would not be rejoicing, which acknowledges without doubt, with a certainty, with an inward sense of having the victory won. With that consciousness, we accept, claim, use, and abide in that understanding. So it's always about the rejoicing. The Philippians were the first Christians which Paul met on the European continent. When he crossed from the old world into the new world, from Asia, Minor Asia, over to Europe, to Macedonia, you say, the first place he touched was Philippi. You say Philippi or Philippi? Philippi. Well, really doesn't matter. And what he encountered there was for Paul always a great occasion for rejoicing. They accepted him joyfully and rejoicingly. They were, as he says to him, a joy and a crown. And so this epistle to the Philippians is also called, anyway, in our language, the Epistle of Rejoicing. I don't know if you have that rendering in the English. He says, rejoice in the Lord always. You see, always. That gives you at once the touch of the ABC, of the C, you see, of being always steadfast in your understanding without any doubt. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again I say, rejoice. So he comes here to a point which we lack so much, that in any situation, whatever the situation may be, we really, as a Christian, should rejoice. We should rejoice. Because only if we rejoice, we give proof of the fact that we don't believe in any power of evil. That we don't believe that any problem has power and might and possibilities and so on. If we would rejoice, we would give the proof that we are really standing above the whole thing. That we really stand firmly fixed in the spiritual idea. So you see, this rejoicing is not so much the end of a demonstration, where we rejoice when everything is over. That's not very difficult. But to rejoice when the thing is not over, to be that mother which can rejoice in the midst of travail by giving birth, she may have birth pangs, she may travail in that birth, may be a heavy birth, but inwardly she may rejoice. That's it. That's the state of consciousness which we should have as a Christian. Now we can have that state of consciousness if we have followed the way from Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, then we can do that. So often we know that we should rejoice. And so often we say perhaps to a patient of ours and say, well, just rejoice. Well, usually it doesn't do much good because it's stating a command, thou shalt rejoice. See? We just say, well, do rejoice in it. But that's the word sense. But if the patient and we can see that this rejoicing is a state of consciousness which is being born through our understanding first of the word, namely, as shown in the first triad, of that word which says, you know, inwardly you can be one with God, and then you partake of the whole nature of God. Then already something within oneself begins to rejoice and says, oh, I see, I already am partaking really of the nature of God.